Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. There's no doubt that there are places in the world where it is dangerous to be a Christian. Actually, it's dangerous to be a Buddhist in some places and a Muslim in some places. Religious liberty is imperiled around the world depending on where you live. What about here in the United States? And why has the U.S. State Department, concerned about our global relationships, renewed its commitment to religious freedom? Joining us to answer that question, Emily Gao. She holds a Doctor of Jurisprudence degree from Harvard Law School. She's adjunct professor at George Mason University Law School. She's director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled, To Protect Human Rights Like Religious Liberty, We First Must Define Them. Emily, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Why is religious freedom a bipartisan issue?
Well, it should be a bipartisan issue. It actually is not always an issue that has bipartisan support, particularly in the United States context. But overseas, actually, there has been a tremendous amount of bipartisan support. Going back to when the International Religious Freedom Act was signed in 1997, and it was actually signed by President Clinton, was supported by both houses of Congress. And I think that's because people realize that, you know, it's a fundamental human right that everyone, everywhere, regardless of what culture or nationality they have, should be able to seek the truth and to live according to whatever truth that they find.
Why has the U.S. State Department begun to put a greater emphasis on religious liberty?
I think it is in part a reflection of the priorities of the Trump administration. I think the ambassador at large for international religious freedom, Sam Brownback, has been very active in trying to reach out to foreign countries to build allies around the world. And he's been very active in reaching out to religious communities of all faiths and civil society to increase the opposition to those dictatorships that repress religious freedom or to social hostilities. And also, obviously, Secretary Pompeo has a deep understanding of the importance of religious freedom. I also think, in addition to this being a reflection of the Trump administration's concerns, I think perhaps it's also a reaction to the increasing amount of religious persecution that we see around the world. The Pew Research Center just released a report last week that showed religious freedom is declining around the world, and that more than 80% of the world's population lives under serious religious restrictions.
Why are some criticizing the State Department for emphasizing religious freedom?
That is a difficult question to answer. I find the criticisms very unwarranted. I mean, there are criticisms that this is a pro-Christian conference, but if anyone actually looked at the attendees of the summit and the people who were highlighted by speaking from the main stage, I mean, there were so many different faiths represented. And it's not just at the ministerial summit that there were so many different faiths represented. Ambassador Brownback has made it a priority to talk about both the ISIS genocide of Christians and Yazidis and other religious minorities, to talk about the genocide of the Rohingya Muslims in Burma, and also to talk about the situation in Xinjiang, China, where Uyghur Muslims, over 1 million Uyghur Muslims, are in detention camps.
Let's define religious freedom for the sake of clarity here. How would you carefully define religious liberty?
Well, religious liberty is a pre-political right. It comes from the human nature that we have, that we are born conscientious truth seekers. And I think James Madison articulated it well when he said that, you know, our highest duty is our duty to God, to our Creator, and that that is more important in time and precedence than our commitments to civil society. Of course, that right has been codified in the international human rights treaties. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So it does have universal assent. And the way that it's formulated in the international treaties, it talks about the right of every person to choose their belief, to change their belief, to manifest their belief in community or alone, in public or in private. And I think it's really important for people to understand that public part, because, you know, in so many societies, unfortunately, there is an effort either from the government or from civil society to marginalize religion to you know, the four walls of a church or a mosque or a synagogue. There's been an idea of freedom of worship that's been floated and unfortunately was popularized during the Obama administration, but freedom to worship is only a subset of what religious freedom really means. Religious freedom is much more than the freedom to worship. It encompasses a person's activities in every sphere of their lives, not only their, you know, what they do on Sunday or on Saturday, but what they do in the workplace or what they do at school.
So you mentioned one way, that is the comparing down of religious liberty or free exercise to freedom of worship. How else has religious liberty been redefined both here and abroad?
Well, I think starting with here, we see that there's, you know, a huge battle in the United States between those who support a robust understanding of religious liberty and those who are advocates of sexual liberties, I would call them, advocates of abortion, advocates of sexual orientation and gender identity ideology, who say that, you know, religious freedom basically means, you know, you can live your religious beliefs out in private, you can live it out, you know, on Saturday or Sunday, but you can't bring it into the workplace. For instance, you know, a Christian adoption agency can't, you know, place children only with a mom and a dad who are married because that is their religious beliefs. Or, you know, Jack Phillips, the Christian baker in Colorado, that he can't live out his beliefs about marriage, you know, in his workplace by declining to celebrate a same-sex marriage. So there's definitely a very strong movement in the U.S. and in Western countries to reduce religious freedom to simply the freedom to worship. And unfortunately, we see those same Western countries promoting that idea at the United Nations, promoting sexual orientation and gender identity ideology, and saying even that religious leaders should be held accountable for what they consider to be hate speech, which is could be anything, could be supporting marriage between a man and a woman, could be supporting the idea that there are only two sexes.
Would you, if we can, kind of paint a picture of religious liberty globally, the state of religious liberty, so to speak?
Well, I think, again, the Pew Research Center has been tracking religious liberty all around the world, looking at the State Department's reports that they issue annually on every country in the world. I believe there's over 100 reports that the State Department issues. And Pew has been tracking these reports for over 10 years now, and they have been tracking the continual decline of religious freedom in every area of the world. And, of course, in some places, it has reached the point of genocide, the two genocides that I mentioned in Burma and with ISIS. And it is across all religions. The Christians are the most persecuted group in the world, but also Jews are experiencing increasing violent persecution, and Muslims face persecution as well. Frankly, every religious group faces persecution somewhere, because every religious group is a minority somewhere.
What is the United Nations track record regarding religious freedom?
Well, the United Nations started off on the right track in 1948 when the U.S. and several other countries drafted the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was the chairwoman of the commission that drafted the UDHR. They did provide a very robust definition of religious freedom. It's actually called freedom of thought, conscience, and religion in the declaration. But in the last seven decades, we've seen increasing conflicts between religious freedom and, in the West, these sexual orientation and gender identity claims, abortion claims. And then from the Muslim world, we see an effort to protect Islam, the religion, from what they call defamation, which is basically criticism or disagreement with Islam. So the Organization of Islamic Cooperation put forward a resolution for several years in a row to ban defamation of religion, which essentially would amount to censorship of dissenters or those who simply, you know, disagree with the tenets of Islam. So there's attacks on religious freedom coming from both the West and the non-Western countries. And now, as the article states, the UN Secretary General has announced a global campaign against hate speech, which I think is very concerning for religious freedom, because that terminology of hate speech so often leads to censorship.
Why does the UN allow countries like Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, China to serve on the UN Human Rights Council?
Well, I think that is a shameful fact that human rights abusers are allowed to serve on the highest body of the United Nations that is supposed to keep countries accountable for human rights. I think it reflects very poorly on how the UN Human Rights Council doesn't have accountability and they don't have standards. I think it's also a reflection of the UN human rights bureaucracy not taking human rights seriously enough to set some standards in place where countries have to meet a certain threshold of respecting human rights in order to merit having a place on the council.
We're talking with Emily Gao, director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., about the U.S. State Department's commitment to religious freedom. On the other side of the break, we'll take up again the subject of that hate speech proposal from the UN General Secretary.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Jesus the Good Shepherd says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life." We invite you to join us as we listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd and follow him who gives us eternal life. Sunday worship services at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible class at 10:30, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri, on the web at goodshepherdarnold.org. That's goodshepherdarnold.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the U.S. State Department's commitment to religious freedom. Emily Gao is our guest director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. I wanted to return for a moment to that proposal from the U.N. General Secretary on hate speech. You say that he is attempting to create a right not to be offended. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is that when you create this concept of hate speech, who is going to define hate speech? Well, hate speech, if there aren't really clear parameters on it, hate speech ends up becoming defined by the person who claims to be harmed by the hate speech. And that often just boils down to when people are offended, when their sensibilities are offended, when they are upset. So hate speech tends to be a very, very malleable term that can easily be abused, and it's incredibly hard to define it and set standards, and it often ends up being just a case where, you know, a person claims that, you know, their dignity has been harmed or their feelings have been offended or they've suffered some sort of emotional damage, and then they want, you know, the other party to essentially pay for that. That's why we don't recognize hate speech in the United States, because we have the First Amendment and protection of freedom of expression. But the U.S. stands alone pretty much at the UN in having such a robust understanding of free speech.
Finally, what are your expectations for the U.S. State Department's new emphasis on religious liberty?
I'm very encouraged to see what has come out of the first and second ministerial summits. I think it's really impressive what Ambassador Brownback has done, bringing all these countries from every region of the world and different faith groups together. Out of the last ministerial summit that happened last year, I believe 5 countries then created an ambassadorship for protecting international religious freedom. I know that there were multiple countries that then held conferences on protecting religious freedom. But I think also one thing in addition to what the states have done is just the fact that Brownback and Pompeo have really elevated the profile of survivors of religious persecution. So without their efforts, I don't think that meeting in the Oval Office with President Trump would have happened. And I've never seen, in 15 years of working on international religious freedom, I've never seen such a diverse group of religious persecution survivors get an audience with the president. And so I think that in and of itself was a huge encouragement and a message to those who would violate religious freedom that the U.S. is not going to ignore survivors. The U.S. is going to stand with the survivors.
Emily Gao holds a Doctor of Jurisprudence degree from Harvard Law School. She's adjunct professor at George Mason University Law School, director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "To Protect Human Rights Like Religious Liberty, We First Must Define Them." Read it for yourself at our website. Click On Demand Archives. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we return, Dr. Doyle Holberg joins us for part one of a two-part series on answering the question, are creation and evolution compatible? What is a life of discipleship? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Luther's Small Catechism, a manual for discipleship. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest, Professor John Pless. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Luther's Small Catechism, a manual for discipleship, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran liberal arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/calla. That's C-A-L-L-A.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The LCMS mission in Gambia is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During July, if you opened a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the LCMS mission in Gambia. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.